The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, a sunny Tuesday here in Southern California. This is the fourth time I've done this intro.
That's right. We had
to do it after we taped the podcast because instead of bleeping the swear words, we just decided to let them ride this one time in the BS Report. So if swear words are something that make you unhappy or uncomfortable or
bitter, listen.
Just turn it off. We're not gonna hold anything against you. But here, fresh off a two-day media blitz.
Mm-hmm.
Promoting his show Louie, which premieres on FX at 10:30 Thursday night. He finished his third season.
That's right.
And now he's here, Louis C.K.
Hello.
What's chappening? Tell me about season three. You said it was the hardest season you've had to do.
It was the most difficult season we've done so far. It's just we did more logistical. We traveled. I did an episode in Miami. We did an episode in Boston. We did an episode. I went to China in one episode, and so the whole show.
You went to China?
Yeah, we shot in Beijing. I hate to give it away, but I can't keep it inside that I went to China. It was
holy
such
mackerel.
A crazy thing.
How long were you in China?
Just 2 days. Shot it for 2 days. Got the hell out of there. It's crazy. So we did a lot, and we wreck some cars. We do a lot of fun action in this season, and also there just was a lot of great actors and more. I wrote longer scenes and stuff like that. I just wrote more. I wrote the whole season before I started shooting. That was the smartest thing I did. But I've been shooting since February 1st.
Yeah,
clear through now. That was hard.
Now, when you finish, so you have this break between season two and season three.
Yeah, not much, but yeah.
How long was the break?
Well, between two and three?
Yeah.
We had, I finished season two late because I was cutting. I was editing until like July, August or something. And then, I had the fall.
So going into season three, are you thinking, here are the ways I can get better with this show,
mm-hmm.
or are you thinking I need to take this in a new direction? Like, what's your thought process?
Well, as soon as the season is done, I never want to do the show again.
Yeah.
I don't want to do anything anymore.
Right.
It's exhausting. And so I just think, I got nothing left for this thing. But you learn in emotional cycles in your life when you get older to I think I'm older than you, aren't I?
A little bit older. Yeah.
So what happens is you start recognizing those feelings, and you don't believe them anymore. You just go, okay, here's the part where I feel like I never want to do this again. So just cool off, and it'll be okay.
Right.
And then some time goes by, and ideas start creeping up in my head. But I every year I want to completely exponentially improve the show. I want to take it in different directions. I want to get better at what we do as a show. How the show looks and how it's written. And then also I just wanted to keep being unexpected. So,
well, we talked about this last podcast, but you're in a weird position where the show was extremely well received, which can sometimes be a little dangerous.
Sure.
Especially for creative people and especially for somebody like you who you kind of need that fear of failure and all that. And then you have all these people saying, great show. I love your show. And at some point, that can be dangerous.
It can. So what you do is you make it harder. That's why this season was harder. It's like if you do something, everybody says you nailed it. Then in order to keep that fear of failure, you got to make it hard. Next time you got to do a harder version,
right?
Or change how you do it. Just change. Keep taking yourself out of your comfort zone,
right?
Because I think an audience will let you have one victory lap, like they'll let you, if they like what you did, they'll let you do it one more time. And then the third time, they're just like, fuck you. They just hate you for it. I don't remember if I can curse on here or not.
You can definitely curse on here.
Okay. So that's what they say. So between one and two, you try to, you try to get a new, you go off season, you add a slider. If you have high heat and you go around the league once, And the next season, they're going to know you. You know what I mean? So you add a slider, you add off-speed pitches. So
that's the Larry Bird rule. Every summer, Larry Bird would add one thing to his game.
That's what you do, because the next time they have adjusted for you, and then they don't know. And it only takes one new element for them to be just to not expect, not to know what to expect.
Right.
So if you have a great fastball, then all of a sudden, if they can time it, but if they don't know what's coming, the hitter's screwed.
So season three is just all about full frontal nudity then.
That's right. That's right.
Repeated shots.
Yeah.
Just totally gratuitous.
Yeah. Yeah, season three is really interesting. There's some stories that take longer than one episode to tell.
Oh, you haven't tried that before.
Yeah, that's new.
Thing. Yeah.
That's new. So there's a couple of runs that are sort of
not like a Melrose Place type thing where there's a cliffhanger at the end. Right?
No, not at all. I started writing some stories that were taking me, and I'd get to the like sort of a page count where I'd be like, "Well, I'm not done, not even close. I'm just introducing these characters," and then I'd say, "Just keep going."
Right.
And we'll figure out later how many episodes it takes to tell it. It doesn't matter. And I wrote this. I have index cards on my desk when I'm writing. Some of them have story ideas, and some of them just have a phrase. And this season I wrote a card that said, "This can be anything you want." And I had that next to my computer the whole time. So I'd get to, like, this is a 40-page story now. Most of my scripts are like 8 pages, 10 pages or something. This is 40 pages. And then I look at that card and go, okay, keep going. So I've got a few stories that take a little while to tell. Some are still like 4-minute stories, you know.
So. Interesting. So it's like a get out of jail free card or something.
Yeah, just do whatever you
creatively.
Want. As long as you make that work, as long as it's good.
Right. Have you followed any of the Sorkin show started on Sunday, and it became an incredibly polarizing show on the internet? And somebody, I mean, you and Sorkin aren't alike, but at the same time you are a little bit, like, you're both very creative singular voices. Like, what do you think of that? Because this also happened to Lena Dunham with Girls.
Yeah, people got mad at her, and
there was a backlash, and there was a backlash to the backlash, and there's a backlash to the backlash to the backlash.
Yeah, it's like, great. It's great.
You like all this stuff? You think it's
helping? Well, I think anybody who has that going on is lucky. That's great. If you're sparking discussion amongst people, that's exciting, you know?
Yeah.
That's what any art or culture should do. Just make people yell at each other and get mad and polarize. That means you did something really compelling, you know? So
you're pro backlash.
Yeah, sure, you know. People, also, there's different ways of enjoying stuff, you know? Like, I used to love West Wing. That show, to me, was... I just loved it. I ate it up. I'm a big president guy. I love knowing about presidents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wish I was a fly on the wall for every moment of every president. I've read books about presidents. And so that show was just right up my alley. And then movies he's made, like the War? Charlie Wilson's War. I feel like he shat that out. I feel like he was literally taking a shit and he wrote it. And it's so good. It's so good. So this is a very gifted man.
Right.
And then he made a Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. And it's so terrible. It's like the worst thing anybody ever did. And I used to buy it on iTunes. Like, every time it would come out, I'd be like, yeah, I'd download it. Like, I'd walk around with joy inside of me, knowing that I was going to get to watch Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
So you hate watched it?
More, yes, and I enjoyed. I anticipated with more glee watching that show than any show I ever liked. Unparalleled. There's never been a show in my life where I've been like, "Ooh, there's a new episode. I can't wait to see it." And Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip was so embarrassing and just wrong, and took such big bad swings.
Yeah.
That I couldn't stop
watching
it.
What was interesting was the pilot was excellent. Like, I actually liked the pilot.
I was just, my jaw was on the floor. Like, who do you fucking think you are? Comedy writers signing autographs? Like, what fucking arrogance. And so, and to have it done with all this Baroque Sorkin writing, like this really dense, beautiful, rich writing of just garbage, it's incredible. So this show that came out recently, I've been watching the promos and going, oh, let me add it. I don't know. I haven't seen it. So I have no idea if it's any good or bad.
Well, if you felt that way about Studio 60, this one's going to...
I'm so excited. And I'm letting them pile up. Because I know this is literally how much I love that negatively this stuff, is that I know I've strategized this. I don't want to watch it while it's airing because I'm going to get irritated. If I watch one and I hate it, I'm going to want to see episode two right away. I'm going to want to binge watch them.
Binge hate watch.
Yeah, binge hate watch.
Interesting.
That's a good...
I actually like the pilot.
All of this is with a tremendous respect to Aaron Sorkin. Yeah. He's, I mean, Jesus, the You Can't Handle the Truth movie? What is it?
Few Good Men.
I mean, come on, man. Like, he's done enough that he'll never outweigh...
Social Network.
Social Network and...
American President.
Yes. And all his two failures were just spectacular, juicy, gorgeous.
Polarizing.
Oh,
yeah.
God. Something to be said for that. There's something to be said for that. I think there has to be respect paid to a show that you just can't. That you're electrified by every second of it in a negative way.
I like that he had so much confidence in himself that he wrote the comedy sketches himself over having real professionals.
Oh, yeah, and they're just tragically bad because they're sincere comedy sketches.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah.
That's a perfect storm of bad is sincere comedy sketches.
It would
sketches.
Be like if you did a show and you're like, I'm going to – be the reliever. I'm going to be the closer for the Red Sox.
Yes.
No, I'm going to pitch. And I'm going to try to get the guys out. We can use it. We can use stunt footage. No, I'm going to do it myself.
No, I really want them to swing.
I want them to try to hit me.
Yes. But, so that's but he's a brilliant writer. But anyway, so that's to me, if somebody loved hitting my show, it'd be great.
Well, maybe that'll be your swan song for Louis.
It's just a show to just say goodbye in the
season
worst
six. You just
way.
Try to polarize everybody and make it hate watchable.
I've got that in me. Like I have, like on Twitter, I've got 1.3 million followers, and there's part of me that would love to do away with all to get to zero. Like that would be something.
Go backwards.
Getting to 1.3 million is something, but to get down to zero, literally zero, where there's not one person. Willing to fall, just lose them one by one, that would really be something.
I think you would have to tweet constantly and in complete offensive gibberish.
I think that
at all times.
That's pretty smart, man. I think
you almost have to hire somebody just to tweet for you constantly.
You would just have to be noise.
Away.
Yeah.
What did you think about, did you watch Girls or you didn't watch Girls?
I saw a few minutes of an episode. I can't watch a lot of TV.
Because you're busy.
I'm busy and I energy and time allocation is my whole life. It's a very careful formula that I employ.
And some would say you work too hard anyway, even though you have that formula.
Yeah, but I mean, I only work half the week. The other half, I have my kids. So when I have my kids,
I don't believe that. I know you like to say that, but I just don't see it. I think it's like one of those things. You're like that kid in college who, the kid in the hall gets like the 4-0, mm-hmm. and you're like, no, I'm out 4 nights a week. I don't know. I just...
It's
with the library for an hour.
The thing I have in common with that kid is it's cocaine. That's what that's it. It's just a huge amount of drugs. No, I mean, when my kids are with me, when I pick them up at school, it's me and them, and I don't answer a phone call. And when they're asleep, that's when I try to get a little bit done, but I'm always half in the bag. And then I'll watch a little TV and go to sleep. The next morning, I take them to school. And between school, while they're at school, 8:30 to 3, I can usually get one or two things work-wise done.
Yeah.
But not a lot.
Well, one thing you've found time to do is watch boxing. And the last time you did this podcast, so we didn't talk sports at all the last podcast, and it went for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
We somehow didn't talk about Boston or sports.
Yeah.
And then we were walking to your car, and somehow the boxing thing came up.
That's right.
And all of a sudden you got super excited. And we started, I forget what fight had just happened. And then I was like, are you a boxing fan? And you were like, oh my God, you have no idea. And they were like, all right, we got to do another podcast, talk boxing. And now this crazy thing just happened with
Pacquiao
and the judges. And boxing always seems to find its way into the limelight for horrible reasons, never for good ones.
Yeah.
And this is a good case of that.
That's true. There's no great wins that anybody cares about. There's boy, did that guy give that guy a thumping and it's on the front page.
Like when you have like the Corrales Castillo type of awesome fight that all the diehard fans are and it's almost really hard to even get that to trickle into the mainstream media.
It is now. Yeah. Mickey Ward and Gotti.
That's another one.
Those great fights. Yeah. I trained with Mickey Ward for a while. I met him on a movie set and he lives in Lowell, Massachusetts, where he grew up. And I was shooting a movie with Ricky Gervais there. And he was driving vans. He was working on the crew. And
Mickey Ward was working in the crew of the movie?
He was a Teamster on the show. He's driving one of the passenger vans.
Was this, what year?
It was the movie was Ricky Gervais' movie, Invention of Lying. It must have been 3 years ago or something. And they were starting to work on the Wahlberg movie.
The Fighter.
But I work in boxing gyms. I work out. That's how I get ready for stuff. That's how I stay in shape when I am in shape, which I'm not often. But that's how I prepare for things that are important to me. And so I met him, and I was like, you're fucking Mickey Ward. And I told him I work out sometimes with boxers. And he said, I'll train you. You know, if you want, I'll try. I got a gym. I work with some kids in the area, and I'll train you. So I started going to his gym when I was working on this movie in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. He had a little tiny setup, and he started training me. And then I started getting ready to do the special Hilarious that I did, and I took him on the road with me. I paid Mickey to come with me, and we traveled in a bus around the Midwest, and we would stop every day and train, and then I'd do my shows at night. He came out here with me, and we worked out in Freddie's gym.
I don't even know how to react to this. Have you ever talked about this?
I don't think so, no.
Wow.
Not really. Mickey and I went to Freddie Roach's gym, and I worked out there. And then he let us, because I was with Mickey, and he's a god to boxing people. So when they closed down, because Pacquiao was get training for, what's his name, the British kid?
Ricky Hatton.
Ricky Hatton. He was training for that. That's when this was. So they shut down the gym for that, but I got to stay with Mickey. So I got to watch Pacquiao train. But Mickey was a huge gift in my life. You know, he's a great guy. About once a month I get a call from him just saying hi, you know.
Right.
But he taught me stuff about getting through things and about, like, one of the first questions I asked him was, what about when you get to a fight and you're not ready? You're not in shape. He goes, cancel it. You don't get in a ring if you're not ready. Just don't do it. It isn't done.
Right.
You don't fight unless it's all. But he told me a great story that I don't know if he's ever told anybody this. I think it was the sixth round of the second Gotti fight. Gotti hit him in the temple really hard, and he blinded him. And he went back to the corner blind, just seeing nothing. And he didn't want anybody to know because he didn't want to stop fighting. So he just sat there just hearing voices and feeling himself being rubbed down and talked to, and he hoping that it would come back, but the bell rang and he still couldn't see anything. And then he was scared that he would look stupid and walk out to like the wrong part of the ring or something. But he figured, you know, God, he'll come to me. So he took like 3 steps out, totally blind, and felt Gotti approach him, and then Gotti nailed him again in the temple, and he got his sight back. And then he went another 6 rounds.
I think that was in the sixth round?
Sixth round.
I'm gonna have to look
halfway
at this on
through
YouTube.
The fight, this guy took those 2 hits and kept going.
Holy mackerel.
So to me, the thing about boxing is, how do you do that? How do you take that kind of punishment and still do anything intelligent? And how do you still have the guts? And there's very few fights where the winner didn't have a disadvantage at some point, you know, where he had to overcome something.
Well,
so that fascinates me.
It's interesting because the concussion thing has become a huge thing with football and to a lesser degree hockey, a little bit with lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever talks about boxing where the whole goal is to not give the other guy a concussion in every fight. You're trying to knock the other guy unconscious. And you know, now that we know more and more about concussions, like it makes sense that people say Muhammad Ali has Parkinson's and maybe he has a form of it, but I'm sure getting punched in the head by –
No, that's if you punch a guy in the head for his whole life.
Yeah,
then
it's going to be repercussions.
It's going to look kind of like Muhammad Ali. Yeah,
right. And especially like, you know, the last, I'm going to say, 6 years of his career, his strategy was basically, I'm going to let the other guy punch himself out.
That's right.
I can't get knocked out. I'm just going to let him throw haymakers.
Well, that's what Ali's Rumble in the Jungle, that whole thing, that taught me an enormous lesson that I'm still living by. Because when Ali was a young man, he was good enough to win. He just was good enough. Mm-hmm. Even despite himself, it didn't matter what he did. He just had the lightning fast reflexes and great eyes and just ability. So he couldn't be beat. He was like a god. But then when they took all that away from him, and then when he came back, he didn't have that anymore. So what he had to win, he had to dig deep, and he had to be man enough to win. Like, he had to know how to win intelligently.
Right.
And what he figured out was, if I can withstand an enormous amount of pain,
right,
and still be willing to fight, then I'll win. That's what it takes.
I thought the lesson that he taught you was not to invite your wife to Zaire when you're in a hotel room with your mistress the entire time, because they might run into each other.
No, that I learned from James Brown.
Yeah.
So that's what that's to me. I'm 44. I'm competing with people younger than me, and it takes a lot of energy to do what I do, and so I try to think like him. And also some of it is technical. Like I learned from boxing trainers that when you're on the ropes, there's a thing that happens that happens to me in my job sometimes, where you get so exhausted that you call on your muscles and they won't do it. That's what you see that happen to boxers. Like you just they. Their arms are just kind of like barely going out there.
So you're saying like your comedy muscles.
Yeah, or just getting through a week of production, whatever it is, whatever the big thing is you're doing, you go, okay, you try to do a reflex and your muscles won't go because you've totally ripped yourself to pieces.
Right.
So what I learned from this boxing trainer, this guy I'm working with now, is that if you lay on the ropes, you can't completely rest. You can't stop. So you lay on the ropes, which gives you like a 7% rest, you know what I mean? Like it takes like 7% of the weight off your ankles and your body. And the trade-off is you get hit harder. If you're on the ropes, you can't escape the blunt force of the hits. So you trade exhaustion for pain. I'm no longer exhausted when I'm getting hit really fucking hard and it hurts.
Right.
But I'm resting. It doesn't feel like you're resting. But if you ever try it, boxing like that, you take the hits and you lay back a bit. Then you come off the ropes, all of a sudden you have energy that wasn't there before. Like it's...
So you're actually getting... You're really sparring and getting hit and stuff.
Yeah, I spar.
Who do you... What weight class do you go with?
This guy I work with, his name is Raul Frank. He was a really good fighter at one point, and he's older now, but he trains with me, and he's a middleweight. If a heavyweight hits me, it hurts really, really bad.
Right.
It hurts a lot. But also heavyweights are slower. So I've sparred with some heavyweight guys that... Trainers.
I'm always amazed by just when you see boxers in general. Like we saw Ortiz at the Starbucks here in LA Live a few months ago.
He's a tiny guy, right?
Yeah,
he's really small.
I mean, I think he probably fights at a lower weight than his weight class, or he fights at a higher weight than his weight class.
Yeah, he does.
When they have to get into the, you know, they do the weigh and all that. But still, it's like you look at him, you're like,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Ortiz is, he's a little guy. A lot of them are little.
Like Sugar Ray Leonard's like...
Tiny person.
Yeah, he's like
the only
pixie.
Guy, the only boxer I ever saw in person that really intimidated me was Mike Tyson in New York.
Because he's
prime.
Like an oak tree.
Yes. I saw him coming out of the China Club in New York in his prime.
Well, you haven't seen the Klitschkos then.
What's that?
The Klitschkos are the
I've
ones
never
are impressive,
seen them in person.
Because they're like 6'5". I mean, they seem like, all right, those are guys that seem like the heavyweight champ.
Yeah, that's just, and it's like they're impossible. Yeah. No one's ever going to beat them.
They kind of ruined heavyweight boxing.
They kind of did, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
It's like boxing with a tree. It's like, who gives a shit? It turned boxing into a different sport, which is, can you knock down this piece of metal? Like, it doesn't.
Well, this is why, I mean, everybody said this, but we need a boxing czar. And one of the many reasons we need a boxing czar is they should have created a super heavyweight class
to deal with the
Klitschkos, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it would be, like 225
and up. Yeah, because heavyweight is endless, right? You can be like 1,000 pounds.
It's ridiculous. They carefully arrange these 9 or 10 pounds per class, and then it gets to heavyweight. It's like, all right, after this, doesn't matter.
It's a 230-pound guy against a 700-pound guy.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
They should have a heavyweight and then a super heavyweight.
They should. You should have to try to stay in heavyweight.
Right.
It shouldn't just be a thing like go ahead after that.
Because Lennox Lewis was the first guy that it kind of felt unfair.
Mm-hmm.
He was just too
big, and
he's too big.
Also, he's one of the first guys that would just lean on guys.
Yeah, and he's 235 pounds or whatever.
There's that one heavyweight though who's great, and I don't know if he's going to get the fight. I can't remember his name. He's new, and he was a football player or something. He's a new guy.
Oh, has he fought anyone yet?
Yeah, he's just recently. He's won a couple of really great fights. He's tough as hell. He's a black guy. And he either played football or some other sport well, and then he switched to boxing.
I was going to bet anything that it wasn't a white guy.
No, that was no.
Balboa, I think, was the last one.
Yeah, that was it.
Tommy Morrison?
Oh, God, Jesus.
I think he was the last one. Tommy Morrison, very quietly, a decent YouTube You could spend a half hour enjoying Tommy Morrison.
Oh, really?
On YouTube.
Yeah,
oh,
no,
yeah.
He is entertaining.
Had a couple good ones.
And also, he has facial expressions when he fights. Some guys just sort of turn into this thing, but when you can watch a guy really suffer, that's really fun.
YouTube has been a godsend for boxing.
Oh, yeah, you can watch the great rounds.
You can just watch great rounds, and guys like Ernie Shavers, who just came and went and never were discussed, and then you can go online and like the Foreman Lyle fight. Like, all the classics are on there now.
That's right.
So you watch Pacquiao.
Yeah,
and you watched Pacquiao versus Bradley, and
you were,
I'm sure, horrified like the rest of us.
Yeah, but you know what? I love the stories, you know?
So you're in on Bradley.
No, I'm not. I don't think he won the fight.
Okay.
But I'm glad it went the way it did. Because it's a great story, you know? It's like, I'm a Patriots fan, but the year that they went undefeated, I really wanted the Giants to beat them in the Super Bowl.
That's
just a better story.
Come on.
It's more dramatic. It's more fun. And I also like watching my team handle losing. It's a great thing to watch
like
a champion.
Character builder.
Yeah, when you watch a champion win and they go crazy and the teams pile on each other, it feels real good. But like the Bruins this year, when they lost to the Capitals finally.
In game seven.
What an amazing struggle. And hockey players really try hard, you know. It's a really hard sport. And so they get to game seven and they lose. And then watching them do the traditional handshake at the end, which is only hockey. I never see that in other sports. You know, when they line up and they shake hands at the end?
They have the hug shake in basketball.
Right. They do that. But not this formal lineup. And
like
watching the Bruins, and I remember, I forget the captain. I didn't follow the Bruins that well this year, but I watched the captain of the Bruins, like the guy who's fucking, can't remember his name.
Chara?
Yeah, yeah. He led he was like, come on, guys. Like, they were so bummed.
Right.
And they're in Boston. They're in the Garden, and they lose, and they're just depressed. And then he gets them together. Come on, let's go tell them. And then they go, and they line up, and they shake hands. And then you see the Boston goalie say to the Capitals goalie, who was a kid, you know, nice job, kid. And this is a great moment. And you know they're going home now.
Right.
They're going to shower and go home and, you know, not talk to their wives, whatever they do in the off season. But it's a really emotional experience watching them do that. So Pacquiao, who's my favorite fighter alive, and because I watched him train, I believe the guy. You know, I don't think he's a fiction. I believe that he's really what he says he is.
So you're saying you think he's PED free?
I do. I think so. I don't think he fucks with that. I think he's very religious, and I think he's actually has a kind of a weird, outdated superstition of people putting shit in his blood. I believe that.
Yeah.
But so he came to that Bradley fight, you know, having not done as well against Marquez as people thought he should have, and he's a little defensive, and he's distracted by shit at home. So this was like a test for him. And he was so goddamn good. It was one of his best fights, Bradley. He was tremendous. And you could see how much fun he was having. He was really enjoying it. And that he was excited for the victory. And when he took the loss, I was more interested in watching Pacquiao's face when he took the loss. Like, the way he took it, just the disappointment. Like, you could just see it washing over him. Like, holy fuck, I lost? That's a big loss for him.
Yeah.
And it means a lot because he can't call Floyd and say, I won 50% of the fight. Like, it means a lot to him to lose that. But he took it. He took it like a man. And he said, I don't argue with the decision. And
I actually thought he should have been more disappointed.
I think he was tremendously disappointed.
No, but I mean, I feel like he should have done a couple of those. Like, what?
Like a what? No,
just
I hate watching that. I hate watching that. Well, and also, by the way, he could have knocked him out. And Pacquiao has a weird little sore spot, which is, I think he's a very nice person. There's been a bunch of fights, if you listen to Freddie talking to him in the corner, where Freddie goes, please knock him out. And Pacquiao looks away from him. It's happened in a few fights, like Margarito. Freddie wants knockouts from Pacquiao, and he won't do it.
I actually thought he took the last couple rounds off because he was like, I'm ahead.
Yes.
I'll carry this guy the last couple rounds.
Yeah, he did.
I did enough to win already.
That's right.
Yeah.
He doesn't like knocking guys out. I think he really doesn't like to do it. It makes him feel bad. It's a fucking violent thing.
Right.
To hit someone so hard that they lose consciousness. I think I invent in my head, but I believe that when he knocked out Ricky Hatton, really, that was like his last one.
He knocked him out, out.
He knocked him out. He's like snoring.
Yeah.
The seconds afterwards, Ricky Hatton was...
Is he dead out? Yeah.
That was real. I think it hurts Manny to do that. I think it's a hard thing to do. He just likes boxing. He likes the
the flurries.
Yeah, he enjoys the athleticism of it. So I think, but it's his fault he didn't get. I don't believe that it's this huge, whenever a hitter swings at strikes one and two, and then the ump calls him out on three, that's his fucking fault. You put yourself in a position where an ump could take that away from you.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
I just wish Bradley
didn't knock him out. And
he also had a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, Bradley's not. He's not as good. He's just not. And he took a lot of punishment.
He threw half as many punches. He had no power whatsoever.
No.
He fractured his foot in the fourth round.
That's right.
And was kind of, although we didn't know he was hurt, but I mean, I guess people are arguing. Some people are now trying to, everything's about backlash now. There's a backlash now to the backlash to the decision.
That's right.
Saying that, no, Bradley actually controlled the fight. There's this great 14-minute YouTube clip that I saw on worldstarhiphop.com, whatever that site is, where they broke down all the punches that Pacquiao missed, but Jim Lampley thought he hit.
Right.
And, I guess that people are trying to make the case it's like a Hagler-Leonard thing. Which is the most polarizing fight of all time.
Yeah.
Nobody will ever agree.
And again,
won that fight.
Just like Sorkin and Lena Dunham, it's as exciting. That's why I'm glad it worked out that way.
Yeah,
fight him again, and he'll ruin him. He'll kill Bradley, I think.
And I'm gonna say I won't pay for it, and then I will.
You'll say you won't pay for it, but you will pay for it.
Oh, I'll definitely pay for it.
Of course you will.
But I have to put up my whole 4-month charade of how I'm not going to pay for it. This is it. They're not getting my $60. You guys can go to hell.
But it works. You see, it really works.
Yeah, it works. It was very smart. And then I'll set up. Mayweather will be out of jail by that time. I think Mayweather's going to – I used to be on the Pacquiao side.
Yeah, but
I think
Mayweather will beat him?
I feel like he's underrated now.
Well, I think Mayweather – against Cotto was his best fight in a long time.
He was amazing in that fight.
He was really great, and it's really interesting because he really liked Cotto. Like, it was, he usually just makes fun of these guys.
Yeah.
Like, when he fought Oscar, and he came out in a Mexican sombrero.
Yeah.
He's such a dick,
Right.
But he liked Cotto too much to go that far with him. Like, he was kind of gentle with him. There's a great moment if you look at the video of the weigh-in for Cotto and Mayweather. Cotto is like he's a real old-fashioned Puerto Rican guy,
Yeah.
And, he sleeps with that big guy and stuff. Like, he sleeps with a man during training, who's like his friend. Because he's like a kid. Cotto's like a kid,
What?
And did you watch 24/7? You gotta watch those.
I don't think I saw the part where he slept
with he sleeps in a bed with a guy. And it's not a gay thing. It's just like two friends sleeping in a bed. It's this a massive friend of his. This guy's 600 pounds. He sleeps in a bed with him. But Cotto, during the weigh-in, was wearing these little kind of underoos. Boxers always wear these, cool boxer brief. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or they wear a G-string and try to act like a, whatever. But he was wearing these little kind of colorful underoos, like chones, they would call them if you're Hispanic.
Right.
And they are funny. I mean, you couldn't not notice it. And Mayweather was standing next to him, and you could tell he was being respectful, but he kept looking away from him and trying not to laugh. Like, oh my God. But that fight was, it was amazing. Mayweather took some punishment, and he's such a smart fighter. He's really, really smart.
I feel like Pacquiao may have peaked 3 years ago, unfortunately, or 2 or 3 years ago.
I don't think so.
I haven't. When was the last time he fought a fight that made you go, whoa? Manny laid the smack down in that one. I haven't totally gotten that feeling from him in a while.
He beat the shit out of Margarito. He broke his face. And Margarito's a guy who doesn't stop.
I feel like 2 years before that, though, he would have just finished him.
Yeah, I don't know. I really honestly think he thinks it's a brutal thing to knock a person out. And he thinks it's enough. I think that this Timothy Bradley thing may have taught him that, because he is an evolving human being.
True.
But I don't believe that any ability has gone out of his body. I think he's amazing.
I've become more and more fascinated by Mayweather
I think is declining. I think he's getting...
Well, I don't think jail's going to help him. It's never going to be in the joint.
No.
It's never good. The joint is never, there's no plus side ever.
No, it doesn't improve anybody's life.
Yeah, nobody ever said, I'm going to get better at sports. I'm going to spend 5 months in jail. Yeah.
If you're fat, then you can lift those weights like in they show, and then you get a little buff.
Yeah.
But Mayweather's not going
to,
yeah.
When we did the podcast with the president, we wanted to hire a crew to shoot it so it looked nice for the Sports Center clip or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we ended up hiring the 24/7 crew, which they were like between gigs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had like 4 hours to kill because we were in the White House. So we were just asking them 24/7 questions.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
These guys have done all of them.
Yeah.
And these guys revered Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really interesting. And they were saying, like, they always judge the boxers by how seriously they take the road work, how much they run. And they can watch the stuff as they're filming, and they can tell who's going to win the fight.
Wow, right.
And they were saying that Floyd was just, like, his work ethic was insane. And they were saying that he'll never get credit for that because he's such a goofball, because of the gambling, because of his crazy family, and he's made himself such a character. And they were like, the thing that, you know, he's got like a Jordan-like work ethic.
Yeah, he's not going to let anybody beat him. So he'll take as much time as it takes.
Right.
But I do think if Manny fought Floyd, he would change everything he does. Like, Manny just gets distracted by being a congressman and stuff. But I think if he was fighting Floyd, it would be a big game changer for him.
That's funny. Like, Manny gets, like, we just casually say, Manny's distracted by, you know, being a
congressman. Yeah, like, we don't give a shit.
Can you imagine, like, a boxer, like, another, like, Alex Rodriguez? Yeah, it's exactly. Like, yeah, Alex went over
for four. Yeah, just he's a senator from Iowa, just because he's fucking the chairman of the House Ways Means Committee. Yeah.
So, what's the best fight you've attended? Because you've obviously been to a few.
I saw, I like that kid Alvarez,
Canelo Alvarez.
Yeah, he's
all right.
I like
him too.
He's all right. And he's not been tested that much yet. He fought Shane and probably should have put him down a lot faster than that.
Yeah.
And but I like a redhead. I'm a redheaded Mexican, and he looks like me when I was a kid. And I think he's a sincere fighter, and I think he'll do
so. You've adapted him.
Yeah, so I saw him here in L.A. at the Staples Center. And then I saw Cotto and Margarito. But it's hard going to fights because you don't see much. It's hard to see. Like, even if you have great seats, the fucking ropes are in the way. It's like it's not – I like the energy. Like Cotto and Margarito in Madison Square Garden was amazing because the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans.
Oh.
It's the people around you. I barely look in the ring.
Yeah.
It's just the tremendous – it's just a war in there. And it's beautiful to watch. And there's fights constantly.
Oh, yeah.
Constant beer getting thrown on people.
Plus the gambling. You throw that part in, too. It's like people, like, cheering their brains out.
Yeah, that they've actually put way too much of their... Yeah, my wife's going to kill me if you lose. Please.
One of the greatest experiences I ever had as a kid was my dad took me to see Leonard versus Hearns, the first fight in the Boston Garden. Closed circuit.
Jesus.
Which sounded like kind of like gimmicky at the time because it's like, so we're going to show it, we're going to put sheets or however and it was awesome.
So great.
Most of the crowd was actually rooting for Hearns for some reason. I don't know whether he was like the underdog or whatever, but I was like a big Leonard guy and
he
was just going back and forth. I was like 11, but
wow.
But it was awesome. But like when you're in the arena for the right kind of boxing
for
event,
fights,
it's
best.
Amazing. Yeah, it's the best.
It is. When someone starts getting a little momentum and you know, it
I
is
saw Hatton,
amazing.
I saw Hatton Pacquiao.
Wow.
And Hatton had a lot of his countrymen there.
That's right. And then they all had to go home. Like after three rounds. That was really great to hear them doing their fucking...
Yeah, they're doing their songs.
Hey, Ricky.
And then
the second verse, he's fucking down and gone. And you have to get back to England and you're hungover. That was great to send them home like that.
Those guys started probably 8 in the morning.
Oh, God, yeah. No fucking English people. Forget it.
It's 4 in the afternoon. They're all wandering around the lobby of the MGM or whatever. It's like, oh, boy, this could be a hairy night if Ricky Hatton wins.
No. And they don't really have anybody now in England. They had to.
That's
Calzaghe's retired. He was great.
Yeah, Calzaghe was great and never really. What's the defining fight of his? Like, you can't even really come up with it.
He didn't make much of a career of it.
No.
Like, he mostly fought in Wales, like, almost exclusively.
And, that's always a red flag when the guys do that. What was the guy in Montreal who just did that and he got his butt kicked?
Oh, yeah, who was that?
I'm blanking on the names. I just watched that fight on Epics.
Yeah, me too.
Boutte against...
Boutte. Boutte is the guy Boutte...
Boutte... against what's his face?
Can't remember.
This is terrible. I'm just old. I can't remember any of the names. But can I remember that guy's name? Boutte was the guy who would never leave Montreal.
Right.
And he fought the guy who was in the super middleweight tournament. Oh, I'm blanking. And now the boxing message boards are going to make fun of me because I can't remember the guy's
name. Well, just don't just cut this part out.
Yeah, I just, you know what it is.
Don't make yourself look bad.
Edit it later and be like, rah, like say the guy's name.
Somebody else.
But yeah, that guy never left Montreal, and that was like the big rap on him. And yeah. I guess that is a little bit of a red flag.
Well, it's like when you see comedians start out, like young guys come and do stand-up like at open mics.
Yeah.
And they bring their family and their friends, and they bring their drinking buddies and their friends from work to their first open mic.
They're stacking the deck.
And they come out like a rooster, and everybody's laughing, and they get cheered off stage. And that guy's good for two shows, and then he's done. Second show he comes, his friends aren't there, and he just 10 seconds into his first set. I've seen it a million times. 10 seconds into his second set, he's already decided to never do this again.
How important is it to be really heckled by the wrong people in your formative years as a comedian?
Oh, you really need that. You need it. You need adversity to get good. You need to be tested a lot. So, yeah.
Is it one of those things that's almost like boxing where you need to get hit and you need to react on your feet to even
you need
know
to
how
get
it's
the
going?
Ability. Yeah, you absorb pain. You know, the first time you get hit in a boxing ring, you just do all the wrong things. All your instincts are to cover up, bend over, and flail. And that you're just an amazing target if you do that. So you have to do something very counterintuitive as a fighter. When you get punched, you have to just stay right there. You have to stay open and loose and relax because then you're intelligent and you're able to see and, you know.
Because it almost seems like patience is the most important thing you can have there. You kind of wait on it. You milk it.
Yeah.
You fire back at the guy. You're in total control. It's like
exactly.
A command thing almost.
It is. And also to be able to say, yeah, you did that, but you're hitting me is part of my plan. Like to be able to incorporate, you hit me, but I'm still doing what I want to do. I'm actually controlling you through you hitting me.
You use an interesting ploy sometimes. Mm. You'll proactively go at the guy and get mad at him for trying to ruin the show for other people in the audience.
Yeah, that's what I do now. Because I'm not afraid of anybody. So, right. But that comes from those early shows. Somebody would heckle me and I would reel. I mean, this is in Boston, open mics.
Right, yeah. That's
brutal.
You don't want to get heckled in Boston.
No, it's so, and they chant, nah, 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 hey, hey, goodbye. Like, if you don't get laughs for 10 seconds, you're going to get chanted off.
Yeah.
It's so, and also there's a feeling in Boston when you do stand up there and you're not good at it yet that you might get the shit beat out of you. Like, it's not just getting laughs or not. It's not just the humiliation. You kind of I did shows doing open mics where you kind of look in the parking lot before you go back to your car, like you do. And it's not because you insulted them; it's because you sucked. Like the people will fucking wait for a weak, shitty comedian to not only heckle them but beat the shit out of them. So I mean, this was the '80s. Maybe things have changed, but
hey, funny guy.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like that stuff.
Yeah,
where you going?
So you wait or you ask, like you know, a bartender to go outside and see if is there anybody around my car. Can you You just go. So that's, you get used to not reacting the way they want you to and just taking the... But yeah, now when people heckle, I lecture them.
I remember the name of the boxer.
Who's
and you
that?
Can vouch because you were here this whole time that I didn't look at my BlackBerry or anything.
Yeah, no, you didn't.
Carl Frock.
That's right.
Yeah.
I knew it was
going to come to
brandy
me.
Name.
Once I pass 40, like the names don't come right away sometimes, but then eventually they're come. So do you feel like a kinship with the other people who kind of made their bones in the Boston comedy scene?
Absolutely. Because
it's kind of a longer list than people realize.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, geez.
Who's the godfather of that scene? Is there? Is it Stephen Wright?
For me, it's Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
He's the guy I loved growing up. And he was the guy I found out that there was comedy in Boston because loved Stephen Wright. And when I heard he came from a club scene in Boston, that gave me a beacon of, like, I could be a comedian.
Right.
I just thought, I didn't. How do you become a comedian? I figured... You put on a tuxedo and go to Vegas or something. I don't know how the fuck do you do it.
Right.
And then I found out there's a local comedy scene that Steven sprung from. And I loved him. So I started doing comedy in Boston.
It's weird to think that Jay Leno is a Boston comedian.
Jay Leno came before the Boston scene started. But he did like strip clubs.
He came up hard. I mean, he came up hardest Boston you can come up.
Jay is a Hall of Fame guy to me for stand-up. But, he's Boston. Stephen Wright, you know, Dennis Leary, more of an actor.
Now people associate him because he's got the accent even now.
even now with Boston. Yeah, he's from Charlestown. Right. That's really Boston.
Yeah.
That's like, there's nobody, most people in Boston won't go to, they're afraid of Charlestown. Guys in Southie are afraid of Charlestown. But who else? Geez.
Well, they had the guys who never totally made it out of Boston.
Oh, well, there was that huge, you know, like Lenny Clark.
Steve Sweeney type. Well, Lenny Clark made it out, but Steve Sweeney was like a giant in Boston, but I don't know if nationally he was that known.
He never got known nationally, though.
Yeah.
He was really a local guy. Don Gavin was a great comic.
There was ways to play it.
Kenny Rogerson.
If you played the local scene, if you played to the local scene with your material, you could just do it for 35 years. Then.
Well, Boston had a huge comedy scene. When I was starting out in the 80s, there was like 8 full-time clubs, and they were all really lucrative. So if you could make Boston work for you, you could make a ton of money
and also
feel like a star. They're all gone.
Really?
When I went back there recently.
Even the Comedy Connection's gone?
The Comedy Connection is now the Wilbur Theater, and that's like a headliner room for out-of-town headliners. You know, like Jim Gaffigan will play there. Those kind of guys will go play the Wilbur for 3 nights. But it's not – there's no show there on a Wednesday night or Monday. They do a lot of music. It's not a comedy club. It's a theater.
Right.
That's what the Comedy Connection became. The Comedy Connection in Faneuil Hall that was a club for local comics, it's gone.
I guess Dane Cook counts, too, and Gary Goldman counts.
I'd love to see the rankings. Of course. Dane Cook is one of the biggest comedians in the history of comedy.
I wonder if you did city versus city.
I don't think you could beat Boston. I don't think it's beatable.
I think New York would probably be right there.
Yeah, I guess so. There's a lot of history in
New York. But if you're talking about non-New York, Boston might have the most.
It might. San Francisco used to be a lot of people came out of San Francisco, Robin Williams.
You're right.
But Boston, there were so many guys. And when I started, there was an enormous amount of great comics in Boston.
So what's it
and
like to go back?
It was a huge bar to go. It just recently was really weird to go back. I went for a walk. I was staying in the hotel on the Commons. So I went. Warrington Street was the street in the district in the theater district.
Right.
That was the comedy street. Nick's Comedy Stop. And like 6 doors down, the Comedy Connection. That's how close they were to each other. Bitter rivals.
Oh, and by the way, the Combat Zone.
In the worst neighborhood.
Yeah, could not have been a worse neighborhood.
So those two clubs were the two that were always there. And then there was Stitches out in the College Market. And there was Played Against Sam's was this place that was just, and then Harvard Square, there was Catch a Rising Star, which was a huge club. Sold out all the time. These were amazing places, and there was always shows going on.
Yeah.
7 days a week. And I went down there, and Nick's, the awning is still up. And it says who's there Friday and Saturday, but the awning is years old. No, it's not Nick's anymore. It's a dance club, but they just haven't ripped the awning down. It's just gone. And the Comedy Connection is Blue Man Group.
I think my mom might have gone to Nick's in the late 70s after
she
was
dad. Yeah, that was a rough.
That was like a disco at one point, right? What was?
Yeah, it's been a lot of things, and it's a
I hope she wasn't there when it was a rough place.
It never wasn't. It was a place, a lot of shit. I was the last time I was booked at Nick's Comedy Stop back in the 80s. It was always hard there. It was always giving me a stomach ache working there. Really tough guys. So I was watching Don Gavin, and he was on before me. And he wasn't booked. He was a superstar in Boston, and he wanted to go on. So he asked the MC to introduce him as this is his first time on stage. He was just goofing around. So he went on stage and he acted nervous. And he's one of the best comedians ever. And this some fucking big college kid started heckling him, and he's coming acting nervous, but he's coming back beautifully. So it's an amazing spectacle because people think this is his first time on stage.
Yeah.
And he's destroying this kid, just destroying him. This college kid was about 6'5", literally. Uh-oh. And the kid's getting madder and madder, and he's taking his tie off because he can't handle how mad he's getting. And I'm watching that, and I'm telling the bouncers at Nick's, that guy's going to do something.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he rushed the stage, and he punched Don and beat the shit out of him. And the whole place turned into just a melee brawl. And the cops came in and started clubbing people. It was crazy. And I'm standing against the wall going, this is what I do.
Oh, my God. So you went back to film.
To film an episode of my show there, yeah.
And this is the first Boston scene you filmed for Louis?
Yeah. I filmed in front of my house that I grew up in. And I wasn't playing it as my house, but we needed a suburban street. And I said, let's just do it in in front of my house. That was,
that's awesome.
It was weird to go back to the town. Newton is where I really grew up. It was weird to go back to the town I grew up in and have the police cordoning off. They gave us the downtown Newtonville, like this little area that I grew up in.
Yeah.
Yeah, they blocked it off. They had barriers. There was about 30 cops working for us to give us, you know, the space to work in. And the Newton police used to arrest me when I was a kid. I used to be I was in jail there like a million times. So it was weird to have them. I'm taking pictures with the cops. And
yeah.
It's surreal. It's a weird moment in life.
It sounds like we had Dustin Penner on here, and we were talking about the Stanley Cup. And so these guys get the Stanley Cup, and they get to take it.
They take it home.
Yeah, people think it's like, they're going to party with the Stanley Cup. What they really do is they take it to their hometown. They're all from these little tiny hometowns in Canada.
That's right.
And it's the biggest day of the last 10 years for any of those towns.
It's tremendous.
Yeah, because they just homecoming king, basically. We have to talk about this this ticket thing you're doing.
Yeah, that's the big new thing.
The last time on the podcast, we were talking about how...
It was the same thing.
Your pension of deciding that the middleman really doesn't need to exist. You just reach fans directly.
Because I was here when we were just starting that.
You're doing your comedy special, $5.
I had just gone on line.
$5, that's it. You get to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've decided that this might work for
selling tickets
concerts
on the road. Yeah.
For you.
Yeah, because that thing, I mean, when I was here with you, we had just gone on line with that, and in 12 days it made $1 million. And it keeps selling.
Right. That worked. That was a success.
Totally. Yeah.
You were very happy with how that worked out.
Yeah. The most 100% success ever of my life.
Right. And you cut out everybody, which made it even better.
Yeah. Well, I gave a lot of money to the people who worked for
me. Right. But I mean, there was nobody. It was just you and your fans.
That's right.
That's it.
That's right. Because when you... Well, all right. So that worked really well. And then I started thinking about tickets. I want to go on tour. And I get a lot of emails from fans saying... You know, I try to keep my ticket prices low because about 2 years ago, I decided I make enough as a comedian. Like, I don't need to make more than this.
Right.
When you're making TV or movies, it's different because you're getting money from a big corporation to make a thing. And they can decide how dumb they are, how much money they want to give you. You know what I mean? So if somebody wants to pay me $10 million to be in a movie or something, that's their crazy math, right? And they're still going to charge
the same movie price.
Right. But on the road, if you keep inflating your price, the fans are paying it. There's nowhere else to get the money. And once you get to a point where I'm doing theaters, and I'm a partner with a theater, I'm not being hired by a theater. You know what I mean? Like I pay them rent, and then we split profits. That's how it works. So if I want more money, they'll give it to me because they want to fill the theater, but then they'll jack up the prices. And for some comedians, that's a point of pride. There's some comedians or bands that you have to pay $100 to see them. And I think that's like a status for them. Like, hey, I'm a $100 ticket, you know?
Right. I can get that price.
I can get $100.
Yeah.
Well, okay, when I got to about $40, $45 tickets, and the amount of money I saw that I was getting for that was like, I don't need – that's plenty for me. That's a lot of money for performing for an hour of work. That's a stupid amount of money. So
right.
Now the direction I need to go in is people need to pay less. Because most of the money they were paying was for ticket charges. They are a crazy amount. I mean, like on a $35 ticket, you'll sometimes have $15. It's like almost half the ticket price.
Yeah.
And then also the scalpers.
In the secondary market.
Yeah.
eBay, all that stuff.
All that stuff. StubHub. All those companies which are, you know, really bright, smart people who are, you know, providing a service to people who want to be able to get tickets whenever they want them. But who gets screwed is a fan who can barely afford your ticket to begin with. They're not going to get to pay $45. I'd like to charge $45. Nobody gets to pay it.
So how'd you arrive at 45?
Because to me, that was like I looked at what I've charged in the past, and that's always the bottom. Like it's always like somewhere between 45 and 55. But then after charges, a $45 ticket becomes like 75, like after all the shit that had the taxes and everything. So I figured if I go down to 45, most people are paying half of what they paid last year. And we found a way to do it with it. We made a ticketing system that's just on the site. You can't buy it anywhere else. There's nowhere you can get it. It's exclusive on my site. It's very, very low ticket charge. And so I incorporated it into my
So I buy a ticket.
Ticket, yeah.
I have my two tickets.
Yeah, they're yours.
What if I try to sell them to somebody else? You have somehow figured a way to track this.
If you go on a website and you advertise your ticket for higher than it's supposed to be, it says in really, not just in the terms and conditions bullshit,
right.
It says it in bold letters above the buy button that if you try to resell it for more, we can cancel it and we'll refund your money. But the person, and then some places, state by state, there's like laws that protect resellers in some places, and some places there aren't. But the thing that's helping us, I think, is that very low confidence for people. If you buy a ticket to my show this year on eBay, it might not work. The barcode might get canceled.
Interesting.
Yeah, it might not work. And we have that right. We have the right to revoke the ticket. Whether we do or not, we may not find every ticket. You know what I mean? Some people try to hide like where the ticket is. We have some ways to find out. Some we don't. Scalpers are they're very strong. They have a lot of legal money and stuff. So I don't know how many fights we'll win or how many will be given. But if you're buying, you're taking a big risk. If you buy one of my tickets for more than I charged, if you put my ticket on sale for $45, nobody's going to bother you. It's fine.
But if you put it for $245,
yeah, if you're the one who buys it, you might have it might deactivate in your hand.
Here's my fear for you.
This
has almost ruined Pearl Jam's career. Once they got involved with worrying about the ticket prices, mm-hmm. remember that? That all of a sudden they started making their worst music ever. I just want to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. So here's what my worry was. This the power of the big ticket brokers and which again these are very very good these companies do great work. Okay, but they just charge a lot. They've charged a lot. So whenever you start charging a lot, there's a room now for the market to come up underneath you and charge less and compete with you. So that's all it is to me. But when I thought of doing this, I thought, well, they have a lot of reach because they have a tremendous bank of emails and everything.
Big tentacles. They've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. So they can, if I go on the road, those companies can blast out to emails and sell my tickets with a lot of, okay, so I was worried, would I have the same ability? This is a big tour. I'm playing some big rooms.
And the answer is yes, you will have the same ability because in 2012, it's very easy to market yourself.
That's right.
You would not have been able to do this in 2001.
I don't think I could have. Yeah. And I mean, we're 20 hours in now. To the last time I checked, it was 20 hours. We had sold 75,000 tickets.
Wow.
We sold out San Francisco two shows at Davey Symphony Hall, which is a 2,700 seat room. Sold out both shows in an hour, and we've added two shows to those late shows for both nights. They're gone. We've sold out, I think we've sold out 15 shows out of the original 30. We've sold out half the tour in less than a day.
See, what you're describing.
And we've added shows in almost every city.
This is the biggest fear for book publishers, for people who are in the ticket industry, people who run music bands and singers and people like that. Bypassing the middleman is actually possible in 2012.
Yeah, it is. It totally works. I mean, anything I was afraid of,
yeah,
it totally works.
If you have enough Twitter followers and you have a Facebook and you can go on four or five TV shows and radio shows and podcasts or whatever, you can get the word out.
Yeah, and by the way, we did this with no advertising, zero advertising. What I did to sell these tickets, is you're the first person I've talked to about it in person. I did Jay Leno, but most of the tickets were sold before that aired.
You pushed it on your Twitter feed, right?
I didn't even tweet about it. When most of these tickets had sold.
Really?
I sent an email blast out to the people who bought the Beacon Special.
So you kept all those email addresses.
I have 220,000 email addresses that are all, those are all very willing people because on my website, when you opt out, when it says like, do you want to opt in or opt out to the email list? Most companies check opt in for you. They tell you that
they
that
sneak says, it in there.
Yeah, they check it. So if you want out, you got to really be paying attention and make sure. And by the way, I've learned a lot through all this stuff. One thing I learned, like I buy some shit from clothing companies sometimes online and I always opt out. Don't send me anything.
Yeah.
And they always send me stuff. And I always wonder, like, how are they getting away with that? It seems illegal.
Yeah.
But if you read opt out messages, they don't say, don't contact me. They say, I'd prefer it if you didn't contact
them. Oh, they fudge it.
Yeah. So they're, well, you preferred it, but you didn't tell us not to. So mine says you have two choices. One is leave me alone, you fat idiot. And the second one is I'd like to hear if you have something else to sell in the future. And you have to click on yes. So my whatever it is now, 220,000 email subscribers really want the emails.
All people who would probably go to one of your concerts if they bought your...
So they all got tweets. They all got an email from me just saying tickets are there. We put it up and then we just sat there. I didn't tweet about it for a while and didn't spend any money on advertising. And the tour will be sold out with added shows.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would probably take a week. It's almost gone. And these shows don't start till October. There's shows that are happening in January that are gone. They're just going. Washington, D.C., all these places, they're just
Dallas. This is interesting. I think you've stumbled onto something that I think is going to start to keep happening.
Well, here's the thing about it. It's hard. It's hard to do. It was really hard.
How many people are working for you?
One guy did most of it. Mike Berkowitz is my agent. Mm-hmm. He's like 27 years old. He's a kid. And he's the smartest person working for me. Like, I used to have a Hollywood agency, and I fired him a long time ago. Because this kid, he's just this kid in a leather jacket, and he's just, you know.
Right.
On my show, I have an agent who's like 12 years old. It's based on
him. I figured that was.
On him. He's not like that in person, but he's that. Yeah, he's really young.
Yeah.
And he's very unassuming, and he'll just be like, oh, I just had this idea, you know. But, I mean, for doing the tickets this way was my idea, but he executed it. Like, he went to every city in America that we wanted to play. And had to find venues that were willing to do this.
Because they're risking pissing off.
Yeah. Some of them can't. Like, I couldn't play. Last year I played the Beacon Theater in New York. I can't touch it.
And you're not in Los Angeles.
No, I'm not playing Los Angeles. Yeah. There wasn't a good venue. There wasn't a venue. We couldn't make the deal with the venue in L.A. We finally found some obscure theater. I forget what it's called. But then the dates they had didn't work. But we couldn't make it. Nobody wanted to do it. Next time around, probably more people will be willing.
I have a feeling, the world's going to shift in a way where more and more people will be
receptive. Well, what makes me happy is that all these venues, this is the thing. I'm not really in competition with the big companies because they already have the venues locked up.
Yeah.
They're paying them to stay with them, and they have this great thriving system. All I'm doing is going to other venues that they don't care about. You know, I'm playing someplace in Savannah, Georgia. Savannah, Georgia. I'm playing Savannah, Georgia because they were like, hey, we'd love to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm so thrilled to be playing places like that. None of them have corporations next to them. None of these places I'm playing. None of them are like these big venues where you watch it on, you know, you're watching a comedian. You don't want, you know, I wanted to play MSG. Like that would have been exciting for me to play Madison Square Garden. And I could have played it. I mean, we put five shows on sale at a place called the City Center in New York. And it's 2,500 seats. So that's, what is that? How many? What's 2,500 times 5?
That's 12,500.
Okay. We sold that many tickets like in about 12 hours. So five shows are sold out in New York. Just gone. So we're adding five more shows.
MSG would have been nice.
It would have been really nice. But I'm doing more shows. I'm doing 10 shows instead of one. But I'm making way more money than I would have made at MSG. Like, tons more.
You could add Stephen A. Smith as your Howard Cosell for a Frank Sinatra main event type of situation.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. If I'd done it at MSG, then my fans would have paid easily.
Yeah, yeah.
Lowest ticket would have been twice the price, and it would have gone up. And then most of them would have gotten them on StubHub for like $500 on the day of the show.
Right.
And they would have had to go into MSG and go up a ramp and sit with a LeBron James cup or whatever it is, you know, with a Carmelo Anthony cup, drinking a soda, watching me on a big TV.
Yeah.
Because I'm too far away to really look at. To me, I would have made a lot of money. It would have been cool to play MSG. But
that actually brings
Do this. I'm doing 10 shows at the City Center. It's a ballet theater nobody's ever heard of. I couldn't play the Beacon because MSG owns the Beacon.
That brings up an interesting point, though. What is the maximum amount of people you should have for a comedy show that's a realistic number for everybody to enjoy it? I would say 2,500
3, is a sweet spot. I have played, the biggest room that I've played that I really loved was the Chicago Theater.
How many was that?
3,600 seats. And I did two shows there in one night.
And you felt like the person the way back, you could still...
I felt really great. But that's how I felt.
Right.
I did get emails. I get a lot of feedback from fans through Twitter and emails. I don't answer them, but I read them. And they always tell me what happened. And I always hear, like, some guy ruined it for our whole section. Like, that's one thing I got from Chicago. There was a drunk guy in the back section. He ruined the show for, like, 150 people.
By
that
doing
left
your jokes?
Angry.
Or
no,
like
just being loud.
Drunk.
I didn't hear. He's one of 3,500 people. I didn't hear him. I didn't have the awareness to police him. There's too many people for the ushers to get at him.
So
2,500 is an excellent.
What's the smallest number you could go before it starts to get weird?
That doesn't. I mean, I used to do comedy for 12 people. You know, I did comedy in New York in the 90s when the bottom really fell out, and you'd go to the Comedy Cellar and they'd literally make you do a show for an empty room,
right?
Because the owner smartly thought, if people peek their head in and there's nothing going on, you know, you got to prime the pump. So literally you'd go on stage.
There'd be nobody in the room?
And you'd do jokes for nobody. Nobody. And then somebody peeked their head in and they'd sit down. Now you'd have one. And that might be all you get all night. And he just had to, that. He kept us alive. Like, it was a guy named Manny Dorman who owned the Comedy Cellar. He died. But Manny was, we thought of him as an ogre. He's making us do shows for, he kept comedy alive all those years. If he hadn't done that, his club would have closed. And now it's a thriving, I shoot my show there. But,
wow.
Yeah, so there's no bottom. There's no, you know.
That's interesting you shoot your show there.
Yeah.
The other thing that's changed since the last time we saw you, you hired an editor.
I did, yes. Yeah,
for season three.
Yeah, yeah.
You finally decided.
Yeah, that was the one thing that was too hard to keep doing.
That seemed like it was a little crazy.
Yeah, I love the editing. Creatively, I love the editing.
Yeah.
I do think it's like where you become Jay-Z and you really mix the show. So it's like when you really make it happen. And I still edit the show, but I'm working with an editor.
But at least you have somebody who's
I have somebody who, she does the first cut and she helps me. And but I sort of put the show together still. But she cuts the scenes and she's very talented. And I decided I would only get an editor if I could get the best one. And to me, that I said it like a joke. Get Susan Morse. Let's start there.
And
when she says no, we'll work our way down the system. And she said yes. She was around. You know, editors are not rock stars. They just work for the money. They're not as highly regarded as they ought to be, I think. Thank God for me. I'm lucky.
It sounds like how we got the 24/7 crew. It's like, really? We can get the 24/7
crew? Exactly. They're like,
they're between 24/7s. So
why the fuck not?
Yeah.
No, she's great. And I was turning in the episodes that weren't as good as that. It was the one job I was starting to do poorly because of the workload.
It was slipping. So what, without giving anything away, what characters from season one and season two have reappeared in season three, if any?
The kids are still there, and they're strong in the third season. And they're growing, and they're interesting. And outside of them, Nick DiPaolo's in a few episodes this year. Just he's got a bit of a presence. I always have Todd Barry throw something in, but then not any real big characters. There's none of my sisters that have been on the show are in this season.
No Chris Rock?
Chris is in. Chris is in an episode. Yes,
He's
in one episode.
How about Pamela? The
Pamela's
non-love interest.
Not in this season. No.
Okay.
Not in this season.
She's out.
That airport scene was that.
That's it. She's out.
That was it. Yeah. No. This season's very different. This season's really different.
Doug Stanhope's out.
Doug Stanhope, no, not yet. He's gone.
We assume he just drove off the bridge at the end.
That was the end of him. He's gone.
They're still peeling him off the telephone pole.
Yeah. But there's great. There aren't a lot of people that carry through. There's a few. Maria Bamford, who's one of my favorite comics, she's very unheralded.
Yeah.
She's in two episodes. So she's got kind of like a little arc. Parker Posey is in a few episodes. She's got kind of like an arc through the season. Melissa Leo is in one episode and she's tremendously good.
I always liked Parker Posey.
Yeah, she's really a really
She's
unique.
The darling. She's one of those darling of the indie scene, quote-unquote, people for like 5 years. She had a big run with that.
Yeah, I never cared about indie movies much. I never cared about them. But when I saw Parker and I did a table reading of a play together for a charity.
Yeah.
And I'd never met her or worked with her. And she just... You know, when you do a table reading for a charity, you don't go rehearse or do much. You just sort of show up and do it. And so I watched her sort of kind of squint at this script and make a decision of how to play this character. And she was tremendous as this therapist woman. She just was so good. So I wanted her in the show. So she's got a two-part run that she does. That's
did really... did you hit that weird point where the show has become successful and likable enough that people are coming up to you and kind of hinting that
they'd
you
like
know,
to
celebrity
be on
people?
It. Yes.
Hey, you know, if
yeah,
I'm kind of free the next few months, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, sometimes somebody very famous will come up to you, and but they don't say it like that. That's like that would be
how
like
do a, they say it?
That gives you an out. Hey, yeah. I'm around. They say I'd be happy to do your show. They say it like you just asked.
I'd be happy to do your show.
They say it like you just asked. Listen,
so
I love your show,
like,
and I'd be happy to do it. Thank you. Yes, I will. And I'm like, oh well, that's. I always say that's great. That's great to know. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, that's great to know. That's interesting.
Know.
That's kind of your own out.
Yeah, because it is. It's great to know that that person would want to be on my show.
So, like, Tom Cruise calls and says,
I got no use for
Tom Cruise.
I mean, you know.
I'd love to be on your show. I'm like, okay, Tom Cruise, that's great to know.
That would be hard to think of something for him to do. That would
yeah, he's
be good
too
for
famous.
My show.
That would not
you know,
fit
he's
in the
actually
world.
Pretty malleable. He's done some, like, the thing he did on that Ben Stiller fake war movie thing. That was pretty great, that agent character.
Right.
That was pretty great. The thing he did in Magnolia was pretty. I think he's.
He was great in Magnolia.
Yeah, he's really talented. That guy's. And he's a veteran, you know. He could.
Listen, you're pitching the Cruise choir. You don't need to.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need to ship me
yeah,
on Cruise.
Yeah,
I've been
yeah.
with Cruise for 30 years.
Yeah. He's great.
The move with Cruise, I think, would be to take his cocktail character, Brian Flanagan, and just you're in a bar and he's just bartending and you don't even really address
just
it.
Just have him there.
Yeah, it's like, it didn't really work out for Brian Flanagan.
It's tricky, too, because a lot of shows like Curb have done great versions of like running into a celebrity, you know?
Right.
And my show has a showbiz reality.
Right.
So if somebody's,
which you did with Chris.
Right. If some people are, if someone's too big, they can't play a character, you know what I mean? Because I am in show business in the show. So Melissa Leo is one thing. She's a character actress, and she was perfect as just this towny girl that I go out for drinks with.
I always thought that was an interesting line with Curb when that person was like, I felt like they were probably famous enough to play themselves, but they're playing a character.
Right.
And it's like, well, you also could have played yourself. Yeah. Like, well, yeah. So you're, you know,
it's
what
a
mean?
Weird line. I mean, my default always is just to use a really great working New York actor. New York is just, it's lousy with great, great, great actors. And they come and they work so hard. You don't have to work around their dates. There isn't this thing of like, you know, we have this guy for one day. And then there's guys like F. Murray Abraham's on again this year playing a different guy.
Nice.
And his scene in this season is one of my favorite things. So Robin Williams is on this season.
Robin Williams?
Yeah, we became pals, and I wanted to put him on, and I had that problem with him. Like, I don't want him to be like a celebrity that I run into thing, but I don't think he can. He's a comedian. I don't think he can play a part. Like, he can't be a clerk in a store. So he is himself.
You couldn't be the bearded therapist?
Yeah, no, that's what wasn't going to happen. But he plays himself, but I don't know him in the show.
Oh.
Like, we don't. It's us meeting, and we have a common experience. It's a really interesting episode.
So, who won the season 3 Doug Stanhope Award for a person actor who exceeded your
totally
expectations?
Totally blew me away.
Yeah, you're like, holy shit.
It's so scary to say it because it's. I don't know if I want to keep this a surprise.
Then don't say it then. I want to be surprised by season 3.
Yeah, it's a guy you're not going to believe who's on the show. It's a guy who's known, but not as an actor.
Oh, good. This is good. See, now you've whetted my appetite.
Yes. There's a guy who's going to show up in episode 10. No, 11.
All right.
Episode 11, there's going to be this guy on who is not an actor, who's who's an icon, and he turns in a massive – he's the best actor I ever – he's like Henry Fonda. It's unbelievable, this guy. He's great.
I'm looking forward to
that.
Yeah,
but I'm going to bury that. I don't want anybody to know. Anybody who knows who he is, some people won't know him on site.
Okay.
But when they see him, they're going to go, is that fucking that? Are you serious that it's that? And then you'll assume that he's just in for a couple of lines or something, but
right.
He carries an enormous weight. He's a two-episode character.
Okay.
He carries an enormous weight, and he kicked ass. And it was another total unexpected. Best actor of the season, I think.
All right.
He's
the Doug Stanhope winner. Who won in season
Doug
one?
Doug Stanhope was probably the best actor I had last year.
Who was
year.
season one winner?
I don't remember season one anymore.
Yeah, it's too far away.
Yeah, there wasn't. You know what? Maybe Tom Noonan from the God episode, the guy who tells us how Jesus got killed. That was pretty great.
I've been with him since Manhunter.
Yeah.
He was awesomely weird and creepy in Manhunter.
Do you see?
Yeah.
This is a butterfly. Do you see?
So maybe Pacquiao in season 4.
That would be nice, yeah. I would have Pacquiao on.
After
sure.
he loses Congress.
Sure.
He loses to Mayweather.
Yep.
Bringing this full circle.
Now, you're going to be really surprised who's on this year. There's a ton of people on, and you're going to be surprised and be surprised what they do. Jerry's on. I can tell you Jerry's Seinfeld's on because because it fucking leaked out. But Jerry does something that he's never done.
Good.
Jerry's totally different than what he does. He's not that sarcastic, aloof guy. It's a whole other fucking move from Jerry. And I think it'll be a new thing for him. It's pretty great what we got out of Jerry.
I'm excited. So 10:30, Thursday night,
every
FX.
Starting this Thursday.
Starting Thursday. And then the site is
Louis C.K. LouisCK.com/tickets.
So LouisCK.net.
That's right.
And that will have all the tour dates.
All the tour dates.
Not LA. How many cities?
I don't know, like 25 or something like that. But a lot are gone. A lot of tickets are. You can still see me in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know,
all right.
We're doing okay there, though.
Come on, people of Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Thanks as always for your time.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck with season 3.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Thanks.
Target the sun off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.